Welcome to the FIEC Resources for Church Leaders podcast. You're listening to a seminar from the 2024 FIEC Leaders Conference. For more resources for church leaders, visit fiec.org.uk.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming and joining us this afternoon. As Andy said, my name's Danny Webster, and I lead the Evangelical Alliance's advocacy work across the UK. That means it's how we're engaged in Westminster and in Scotland, Belfast, and Wales, working in those assemblies and parliaments, seeking to engage on policy issues and then help the church to engage in those issues as well. Our focus this afternoon is on the question of a conversion therapy ban. And the first thing to say is that there isn't a conversion therapy ban. So in some ways, I'm not sure it's how we are responding to the question of a potential ban and what might a ban involve and mean. As I was preparing and thinking about this, I came up with an alternative title that I might have structured around deliverance ministries, exorcisms, and hate prayer. Because sometimes if you look at the media and you look at reports about it, you get a very caricatured picture of what is being talked about rather than what's actually potentially going to be addressed and affected by the legislation. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for maybe 35, 40 minutes about what the political situation is, about what a ban would entail and what it would affect. Then I'm going to, as I say, take a break, tell you a bit more about the Evangelical Alliance, take some questions about what I've said, and then in the final section, I want us to talk about pastoral engagement in this area. How can we develop good practice? Because one thing that I will come back to a few times is that, yes, there's a significant question about ensuring that things aren't made criminal, but then there's a second question about how do we have good practice in our churches, and recognizing that there is good practice and there is bad practice. And we're not saying it should be criminal, but there is still a need to build good practice. So we'll talk a bit about that later, and you'll talk a bit as well. I have a sore throat, so that might tempt me into talking less and encourage you to talk more. But as we start, the thing that we need to start with on this issue is a definition. We need to be able to define what is meant by conversion therapy. Because if you're going to pass a law banning something, you need to know what you're banning. And immediately that's the problem we have. Because I've been working in this area for, I was thinking about it, at least I think 7 years. And we've never really got to the bottom. There are definitions. I'm going to give you a few in a minute. But once you start unpicking them and pulling at the threads, you realize that it's not always clear what it means. It's not always clear what the words mean and what the bans would entail. So here's one from a UK Parliament briefing that's a fairly common one. The terms conversion practices and conversion therapy refer to coercive practices that aim to change or suppress a person's sexual orientation and or gender identity. In 2017, there was a national LGBT survey, and they simply asked if people had been offered conversion or reparative therapy in attempt to cure them of being LGBT. In 2021, the UK government consulted on some proposals to introduce a law around this, and they didn't really offer a definition, but they talked about it in incredibly convoluted ways. And actually, the language they used they tied themselves up in knots in what they were trying to say and what they were not trying to say. So you ended up with this about attempting to change a person from being attracted to the same sex to being attracted to the opposite sex. We're treated in the same way as the reverse scenario. This is also the case should a person try to change another from being transgender or to being transgender. What we also see repeatedly is politicians talking quite casually about how awful it is. So conversion therapy is abhorrent, it's abusive, it has no place in a civilised society. Boris Johnson said, on the gay conversion therapy thing, I think that's absolutely abhorrent and has no place in a civilised society and no place in this country. Keir Starmer has said, we'll implement a full trans-inclusive ban on all forms of conversion therapy. We fully support the view that conversion therapy is psychologically damaging abuse. So they're almost kind of saying it's abusive and wanting, without actually saying what it is that makes it abusive. We'll come back to this, but one of the key questions is, what is it that is being made illegal that is not already illegal? Because where abusive practices happen, where criminal activity happens, there is a lot that the law can already do. And I think that should be enforced. And I think something, again, we'll come back to, actually ensuring that the law is enforced well where those abusive practices occur is important. But what we don't want to see, and what is hidden under the guise of the definition, is the risk of a far wider definition of what is meant by abuse. So the definition I'm using for today, it's a very broad one. I can't even say that I agree with or disagree with it, because you've got to define so many terms to actually get to the meaning of the statement. But conversion therapy relates to actions which seek to change, cure, or suppress someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. That's the definition for us to use to think about what it is that the government are talking about. We still haven't actually defined what it may or may not be. Sometimes conversion therapy is talked about as reparative therapy, or colloquially as gay cure therapy. And I think it is worth taking a small step back just to reflect on, why is it that this is something that people, massive generalization here, instinctively feel is so wrong? Because people say, oh, conversion therapy, that's wrong, that's awful, that's a burden, that's abusive. It's because we have adopted as a society a mentality where sexual orientation, and to a more contested extent, gender identity, is seen as an intrinsic part of someone's identity and personhood, that to suggest that that might change is to violate that personhood and to undermine that. And I'm not really focusing around gender identity this afternoon. I'll talk about it a little bit later and we can come back to it in questions, but it is significant that that has become much more contested in our public culture and wider society discussions, that that question around gender identity is intrinsic. Actually, there's a lot more questioning going on there from a lot more people. Two kind of guardrails as we move through this. I think it's important that we recognize and understand and listen to places where the church has caused harm in this area. I think there will be some activity that may have been illegal. There'll be other activity that isn't illegal, we just shouldn't have done it. So I think it's important that we recognize where harm has occurred and that we're not blind to the fact that that has taken place. And I'm not going to navigate the evangelical church's history around sexuality. I could do that next year, but I want to stay quite practically focused in terms of what a law would mean. The second guardrail on the other side is that people do experience some change in their sexuality. Now, that is highly complex and hard to understand always exactly how that happens, and people's stories are different, but we should listen to the testimonies of people who do say that that's happened. I think it's not happened as much as some people may have wanted it to. I think some people have felt that there was hope put on something that didn't actually deliver. But for some people, a very small number of people, they might see their attraction shift from being exclusively to people of the same sex to people of the opposite sex. That is pretty rare. And I think actually, if we look back over the last 50 or 60 years, I think sometimes people having a sense of wish fulfillment around that and wanting that to be the case has not always been helpful. But actually, other occasions, people may feel that they have a particular grace, or that they have got married, and actually they feel that God has equipped them and strengthened them to be married, and actually not haven't changed other things around that. I think listening to an individual person's story and testimony is different to using that as a model for pastoral ministry I think you do not, and I'm drifting into where we'll get to later, we do not want to be encouraging people into marriage to solve the problems. But I think where that, where people feel that they have actually received that, we should listen to those stories. I know a number of people who would still say they see their attraction as probably actually, it probably is more to people of the same sex, but I feel God has equipped me and strengthened me and given me the grace for my wife or my husband. So I think these two guardrails help us to think about there's activity which we actually should recognize as harmful and wrong, whether or not it should be criminal, and actually, but we should also have confidence that people do change and the variety of stories people have. So where are we up to with conversion therapy? I said that we don't have a conversion therapy ban. We don't even have a proposed bill at the moment. We've been through a few iterations. The UK government consulted on plans in 2021, just on the broad policy proposals. They then said that they would introduce a draft bill for a couple of years, never did, and then dropped that pledge. The current UK government have pledged to do that in their manifesto, and in the King's Speech, they said they would introduce a draft bill. And the Scottish government have consulted on proposals to introduce this, including draft clauses for a bill. But I think the best way of putting it is that it's now on the shelf. A combination of changes in the political dynamics in Scotland and the UK government saying, a Labour UK government saying that they will take forward a bill, mean that the Scottish government are basically saying, we're going to leave it to Westminster for now. We may come back to it later. Frankly, I think they're quite happy to not be dealing with it right now because it's so complex and controversial. So, on to the substance of what I want to talk about. What will a conversion therapy ban ban? And we, this is where it's somewhat speculation because we don't have a list. If the government gave you as an itemized list of these 10 activities are what will be banned and these 10 will be exempted, that would kind of help because we could engage with that and say, actually, no, 1, 2, 3, and 4, yes, that's fine for those to be banned, but 5 to 10, no, these are things that we want to protect. We don't have that. So we kind of have to work at thinking, how will these laws affect different areas of life? So I'm just going to run through 7 categories, and then I'm going to go into them in a bit of detail. So I'm going to talk about aggravated offences. I'm going to come back to each of these. Formal talking therapies, church teaching, church discipleship, prayer and pastoral ministry, individual conversations, and family and parenting. And let me just check my time to where I'm at. And in about 13 minutes, my aim is to do that. So aggravated offences. An aggravated offence is something that is already criminal. So if I assault someone, that is a criminal action. But then if I assault them because of their race, that is an aggravated offence because it's a racially motivated crime. The proposal is that conversion therapy laws would add an aggravating offence if the motivation is to change someone's sexuality or gender identity. There is almost a side conversation about should we have aggravated offences? Should all assaults be treated equally? I think that's interesting. I think as a matter of legal precedence, we have that in our system. We have generally not opposed this when both in Westminster and Scotland they've been proposed. This is talking about activity which is criminal already. This is not broadening the category of what would be captured. It's just increasing the sentencing tariff on those activities. And then formal talking therapies. I think this is what most people have in mind when they think about conversion therapy. They think about someone going to a therapist and saying, can you make me straight? Or can you stop me being gay? Or the other way around, the therapist says, I can offer this, I can help you. Such ministries and activities are pretty rare. It's not that they don't exist, they're pretty rare. But one of the key questions around this is consent. When in 2021 the UK government consulted on this, they suggested that adults should be free to consent to activities such as this. The charge that came back from campaigners for the ban is that all conversion therapy is abusive, and beyond abusive, they would say that it is categorized as inhumane or degrading treatment and therefore should be treated as such, and therefore consent is no defense. You cannot consent. Like, you can't consent to be tortured. That's an established principle of international law. But they are then seeking to bring that so far into this, say, actually, you can't consent to something which might offer you therapies around your sexuality. There's circular reasoning here, that they have to define something as having such a high level of abuse in order to bring in the argument that you can't actually consent to it. But that is I think one of the things that is in view first when a conversion therapy ban is talked about. We haven't primarily engaged around this issue. We've sought to primarily engage on the areas that I will come on to, and I know for the Christian Institute, they too have also sought to engage primarily on the ordinary work of Christians and of churches, and we felt that that's our place of focus. I think I would make an intellectual argument that people should be free to consent to quite a wide range of activity, even if you disapprove of it. So actually, the fact that in a society we might stop people from engaging with activity that they choose is quite illiberal. And I'd also say that as a society, we accept quite a high degree of activity that actually, I would say, is far worse. People are allowed to engage in activity that might be frowned upon, that people might consider degrading, but because they choose to do that, we allow them to do it. So I don't buy the you can't consent argument. And it's, in terms of some of the arguments around this, it's got quite complicated in terms of international law and human rights. The other thing here is the question of directive and non-directive counselling. One of the main arguments is that this conversion therapy ban wouldn't affect non-directive therapies or counselling, which means that it would permit affirming therapies and counselling, so that it would affirm what the person says, which is kind of complicated, because what if someone actually comes to a therapist and says, I want this? But in practice, what it means is someone who says, I think I'm a girl, or I think I'm a boy, or I think I'm non-binary, actually there's no questioning of that or no challenge of that. It's affirming. I'll talk a bit more about it, but I don't think the directive, non-directive distinction holds. I think everyone has a framework within which they operate, and I don't think you can just cast something as directive and something as non-directive as easily as that. Another note to make is that some of the terminology has shifted from conversion therapy to conversion practices. I actually don't mind that, because I think it helps us to understand that we're not just talking about what happens in a therapist's office, that this ban does potentially affect a far wider range of activity. I still have problems with the conversion word being in the label. I think the way that's been hijacked so without question is problematic. But actually, talking about conversion practices, I don't object to, and I think is arguably a little bit more helpful. And then on to some of the key areas. Church teaching. Generally, the proposals that have been put forward have said that they would allow an exemption for religious teaching and church teaching. But I think once you get into it, it can feel like a very hollow exemption. So it suggests that actually a church leader would be permitted to get up and stand behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning and teach, this is what the Bible says around sexuality and marriage. But actually, that's not what some people want. Some people would argue that even doing that is inherently harmful and abusive, and they just maybe recognize that they can't get their way with the law at this stage. But the bigger problem is that if a minister is permitted to do that, but then they can't meaningfully pastor their congregation in the light of that, it's an incredibly hollow exemption. There's been some discussion that it might cross the threshold if it's viewed as being directed to a specific group of people. So rather than just teaching the whole church, what you're saying is directed to particular people who might be same-sex attracted. But say in the course of a sermon, the minister went from teaching what the Bible says to application and saying that if you struggle with same-sex attraction, pray for help in resisting temptation. Are they then directing the teaching to particular people? There are many scenarios that we have played out, we have discussed and put to ministers and officials of just how would these things work in practice. And we've largely not had any satisfactory answers. The second area is around discipleship. And within that, the thorny question here of discipline in a church context. If we do assume that what is taught in a from a church pulpit is exempt, how far does that go? And it raises a question that we come up against time and time again with when we engage with the government on a whole host of policy issues. They just don't get how churches operate. So they might say, oh, well, yes, the vicar can teach what he teaches. But then what about a youth pastor? What about a small group leader? What about what's said within a discipleship group or a Bible study group? Does it matter if it's just the leader that's saying it or someone else who's within the group? Once you start getting into what is meant by church teaching, it doesn't really add up and it doesn't really work in practice. And then within this is the questions around church membership and church leadership and what criteria might be put on people within those places and those roles. One scenario that we've repeatedly put is where a church has a requirement for people in ministry roles to sign a statement that both in belief and practice supports marriage between a man and a woman for life. And that as being the only place for sexual activity. But if someone is restricting someone from a role due to criteria like that, is that viewed as suppressing their sexuality? Is that viewed as an abusive practice? I think that there are a whole number of scenarios such as this that delve quite deeply into how churches operate that could be at risk. One of the frequent scenarios that comes up when we think about a discipleship situation, and this drifts into the next section, if someone comes to a church leader and asks for support and prayer to help them resist temptation, what are you to say? How is that categorized and thought about? Would saying that someone should not engage in sexual activity be viewed as suppressing their sexuality? Would praying for them to give them the strength to resist temptation be counted as that? One activist talked about hate prayer, which is why I put it in my proposed alternative title. And they said this: I'm trying to ban harmful prayer that has a predetermined purpose that is directed at an individual with an aim to change. One of the things that gets completely lost in all of this is the nature of the gospel as transformative. The fact that as Christians, we believe that lives change and that change is a good thing in all areas of life. So actually the idea that we don't want people to change would just be impossible. And then you read a comment like that and you're like, well, prayer that has the predetermined purpose that is directed at an individual with an aim to change. Well, yes, that's why we pray. But I think it does come to this question of good practice and bad practice again. I think if you look at some of the exposés that have been on the TV, some of them do involve questionable conduct. And I'm not saying conduct that I think should be criminalized, but I'm saying conduct that I think as churches we should question and actually should lead well and say, actually, we do need to do better, perhaps. One of the joys of working for the Evangelical Alliance is speaking to a very wide range of churches. Sometimes it's helpful to be speaking to a specific subset of the church because you're able to engage with particular church traditions and practices. And it's probably, to make somewhat of a generalization, Pentecostal-style deliverance, exorcism prayers is probably not that common in FIEC churches, but it is the sort of thing that we do need to be aware of when it's used to caricature. And actually, I think sometimes unfairly, I think there's practice that goes on that isn't reasonable, but one of the most infamous video clips that's been used around this is someone being prayed for. They're being prayed for in tongues. And frankly, it doesn't matter what the subject was. You put a group of people praying in tongues on the ITV News at 10, and it's going to look really, really, really weird. And so there's just some questions about that. Come back. Yeah, I mentioned the question about directive and non-directive counseling, how within a framework of Christian belief, within a framework of an orthodox understanding of sexuality, how can we possibly offer non-directive counseling? Because we might not be saying, you've got to do this, we're not forcing people, but it is within a framework of belief that others would view as, well, yeah, you might not be saying they've got to do it, but look, if they don't do it, they're not going to be able to take on a leadership role or be in membership in the church. So I think the directive, non-directive counseling just doesn't work. And then quite briefly, two last ones. I've talked mostly about what happens corporally in terms of church life, but this would also affect individual conversations and the threshold. There isn't a threshold. It's like, well, what is a church activity? What's an individual activity? If it's two people within a Bible study group talking, does it matter if one's the leader or one's not? Actually, how do our individual conversations, someone, a peer talking to a peer after church, how do any of those situations, how are they affected? And then finally, family and parenting. This is such a huge issue. You should have been not here, and you should be in Ed Drew's seminar, because he's talking about, I think it's parenting in a world of sexual confusion. And I said, like, Ed's great. I have a slight vested interest as being a trustee of Faith and Kids, but it's really important. It's just not what I'm talking about here. It does bring in questions around gender identity more, because this is so important with children, how parents do feel able to ask questions and to parent well, rather than feeling like, I can't say anything to my children because I might be breaking the law. There's really important things in play here. So before we pause, will this happen? And when will this happen? That's like a $1 million question that if I knew the answer to would make my work planning an awful lot easier. The government have said that they will introduce a draft bill in this parliamentary session that will run until summer or autumn of next year. So based on that, the assumption is that sometime between now and next autumn, there will be a draft bill published. And what that means is the text of the bill will be published, but it won't start its normal parliamentary procedure. It will instead be scrutinised by a committee in Parliament. And that is a good thing, because it gives it an additional layer of scrutiny and attention. I think the indications are that government are realising that it's complicated. The same civil servants that had told the last government that this is complicated are now telling the new government that this is complicated. The same legal advice that my friends at the Christian Institute have produced demonstrates that this is a minefield, that the human rights challenges are huge here. No matter how different people have formulated the laws, whether in Scotland or in Westminster, the human rights challenges are significant. The questions around gender identity are really important as well, because there is far more opposition and questions about actually, well, what are we doing in this space? The CAS review that looked at questions around particularly the treatment of young people in the NHS has sparked a much wider questioning of an affirmative approach. So that, and politically, that's causing problems for Labour. There are a lot of women in the Labour Party who are making a lot of noise about the party's position around issues around trans and gender identity, and its inclusion within this bill could be really problematic. And we want to acknowledge that, but we also want to say that there's plenty others aspects that are problematic as well. So yeah, we could be looking at a draft bill in the new year, we could be looking at a full bill in the autumn, or we could be waiting in 2 years' time because they've realised it's really complicated, which it is. So we just don't know. I might have sounded a little bit optimistic about the fact that there is concern around it, there is understanding of its complexity. The other side of that is we have a parliament full of new MPs who were voted in, or 400 and however many of them, on a manifesto commitment to do this, who are classically fairly progressive in mindset and approach. I think it is a really significant challenge. I think if it comes into Parliament, it will be a real challenge. But we are continuing to engage. And I think one of the things, and actually this is a helpful little segue, I've been really encouraged over the last couple of weeks around engaging in Parliament, and not on conversion therapy, but on assisted suicide. For the last couple of years, conversion therapy has been like the top priority issue, and it's just dropped down now because assisted suicide has taken that place. So if you don't know, there will be a vote and debate in Parliament at the end of this month. That's not the end of the road for it, but that's the first major parliamentary vote on proposals to introduce assisted suicide. But actually, I think a few months ago, I thought, oh, gosh, all these new MPs are going to naturally vote in favour of it. But I don't think it's going to go that easily. There have been significant voices across the political spectrum who have said they won't vote for it. Wes Streeting, who's the Health Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, who's the Justice Secretary, have both said they'll vote against it. Ed Davey, the Lib Dem leader, has said he's minded to vote against it. And I think actually MPs, once they think about it, once they're informed, are starting to have more questions. And that, I'm not taking that for granted, but I think there is a bit of a door ajar that we need to continue to push, and we will continue to push in the coming weeks. It's why I want to encourage you to engage on all sorts of political issues, whether it's conversion therapy or assisted suicide, to engage with your MPs, go and see them or talk to them or even invite them into your church. Church leaders generally have a really good opportunity to build relationships with MPs. Sometimes you may have hosted hustings or been involved in hustings ahead of elections. One tip, invite them to a carol service. MPs are not going to say no to a carol service. It's a great opportunity just to build a bit of connection that you can then use to build that relationship in the months ahead.